I'm going to tell you three stories about some early pioneers of the lesbian and gay press in the United States. I'm not going to talk about one magazine or the Mattachine Review or the Ladder or a few others that you may have heard about. But instead, I'm going to talk about three virtually unknown gay and lesbian newsletters that were started in the 1940s and early 50s. And in a sense, what I'm going to tell you today is an event in itself, because it's the first time that the names of two of these newsletters have been made public. One reason is that I've discovered these early publications just from doing oral history interviews with women and men in the process of writing my book on gay Americans in World War II. And I think the more and more those of us who are younger talk to lesbians and gay men who are older, the more we're going to find out that there was a lot of attempts at starting a gay press and a lesbian press long before what we know about today happened. The people who started or subscribed to these newsletters are the most eloquent in talking about their efforts, so I'm going to use the words from their interviews whenever I can. Then I'll end by saying a few words about why I think these stories are especially relevant for those of us who are here at the conference today. Okay, the first story I'm going to talk about takes place during World War II, and it's a story about a newsletter done in the Army called, a gay newsletter called the Myrtle Beach Bitch. In 1943, Norman, one of the men that I've interviewed, was sent to Hunter Field, an Army Air Force base near Savannah, Georgia, as part of the Special Services Unit there. Special Services put on entertainment for the troops. "We were putting on a musical comedy," he remembers. "During the rehearsals, they found out that there was a time slot they needed to be filled. Well, I had two buddies, and the three of us decided that we would do a comedy drag routine. So we got together a little skit and wrote a little song, and we did a dry run for the cast and crew, and they really loved it. It broke them up. The next day we went into downtown Savannah, and we walked into this dress shop and happened to find a woman there who was quite liberated for her time. We told her that we were doing the show, and could she contribute some dresses? Well, she was absolutely blown out of her mind to see three soldiers walk in and ask for dresses. But she was very cooperative, and she took us into the dressing room where we tried on a lot of gowns. And she gave them to us for free, for the war effort, she said. With the understanding that she and her husband could have complimentary tickets to attend the performance. Well, the first night of our show, right in the middle of our act and our song, there was a blackout, which happened in those days, and when the lights came back on, this bee that had a nest in the wings of the theater came out and stung me right on the nose, and I fell off the stage right into the lap of a colonel in the front row. Everybody thought it was part of the act, so we were asked to keep it in. Each night, we ended the act by coming out for an encore, and after the applause died down, we lifted our dresses and roller skated off the stage, just like Bee Lilly." She was a comedy singer at that time. "From Hunter Field, I was transferred to Walterboro, South Carolina, and my two friends were transferred to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. One day, I got a letter from my two friends in Myrtle Beach saying they were going to publish a monthly newsletter, because there were a lot of gays in the Air Corps, among the higher ranks as well as the PFCs and the privates. So they produced a newsletter which they called the Myrtle Beach Bitch. They wrote about who was going with who was sleeping with who divorced each other and was going with someone else. And so the Myrtle Beach Bitch went on for quite some time, and it was almost like receiving a newsletter from home, because it was the only communication we had about people we had met in other bases, and it let us know who was overseas and where they were. It was just a mimeograph, standard-sized piece of paper, and maybe it consisted of four or five sheets that were stapled together. And it was mailed to those people who were on the mailing list, and they in turn would give it to someone else, and if they wanted to be on the mailing list, they would just go ahead and send in their name. You see, people didn't save things in those days because we were all so afraid, not only of the service, but of our families. But people saved the Myrtle Beach Bitch. One particular issue was a parody on the night before Christmas. It went something like, 'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the field not a single queen was stirring, not a single high heel. One issue also printed the words from the song we wrote for our comedy drag routine, which we called Isn't It Campy? Here you see three lovely girls with their plastic shapes and curls. Isn't it campy? Isn't it campy? We've got glamour, and that's no lie. Can't you tell when we swish by? Isn't it campy? Isn't it campy? Those GIs all stop and stare, and we don't even bat an eye. You'd think that we were shy, but we really don't care. Now isn't that campy? So now drink a toast to these lovely girls doing their utmost to upset you most. Now, who do you think is campy? Well, what happened was the Myrtle Beach Bitch got into the hands of someone who turned it in. The two fellows who produced it had made the mistake of not camouflaging or changing the names. They just used the actual names. Well, there was a big purge. All the men whose names had appeared in the newsletter were called before the board, they were reviewed, and they were interrogated. There were hundreds involved. My two friends at Myrtle Beach were court-martialed and convicted for using the government mails to send vile and obscene materials. They were sentenced to 1 year and 1 month at Fort Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. My name also came up on the Myrtle Beach Bitch mailing list, and they called me in. They wanted to know if I had known any of these people. They had a whole list of a couple of hundred names of people that were in Savannah, and people that were in South Carolina, and people that were in North Carolina, and even overseas, and they wanted to know how many I had had sexual contact with. I denied having sex with any of them because I didn't want to put anybody on the spot. They sent me to psychiatrists, and then they interrogated me, and then they put me in the hospital under observation in a locked prison ward with German prisoners of war. I will never forget the day of my discharge. It was almost like being in front of a firing squad. I was called out early in the morning from the ward, and the platoon was at attention, and they called my name, and I stepped forward. They read the charges off and then stripped my stripe off me, and they ripped off my medals. I don't even remember what the officer said because my mind completely blocked out. I just felt all these eyes upon me and could hear them mutter, fairy, fruit, cocksucker, and I wanted to block it all out of my mind. It's almost like I had fainted. The next thing I remember, I was in JCPenney's, and they bought me a civilian suit because I was not allowed to wear the uniform, and they put me on a bus back home to New Jersey. And that was the end of my service. And that was the end of the Myrtle Beach Bitch. Toward the end of World War II, a woman named Lisa Benn, that's her pseudonym, I rearranged the letters in the word lesbian to make the word Lisa Benn. Pretty ingenious. Toward the end of World War II, Lisa Benn left her parents' home in a small Northern California town up here and took a bus down to Los Angeles to find secretarial work in the movie studios there. She moved into a women's boarding house where she met other gay women for the first time. They lived on the floor above her. They introduced her to lesbian social life by taking her to women's softball games and dancing at the IP Club, a lesbian bar in Los Angeles. Her wartime coming out experience so radically changed her life that immediately after the war, she started the first lesbian newsletter in the United States, which she called Vice Versa. A few years ago, Lisa Benn described to Leland Moss, a writer for Gays Week in New York, how she started up her little magazine in 1947. I had a lot of time to myself when I was secretary in the movie studio, she recalled, and the boss was out a lot, so I decided I would make up a little magazine to while away the time. I thought I'd make up a gay magazine because I had never seen any on the newsstands. I thought it would be great if it were a real magazine with a printing press and all that, but I couldn't do that, so I typed it out on a typewriter. In those days, we didn't have Xerox machines, so I typed 6 copies at a time, 5 carbons and 1 original. I typed the whole magazine page by page, then I'd begin over again and type 6 more, so that each printing there were only 12 copies, which made it a darned exclusive magazine. I didn't really want it to be that exclusive, but I had no other recourse. There would be a preamble, a movie review. There were very few movies that dealt with that subject in those days, but even if there was one that only hinted at it, I would play it up. And I'd write poetry and maybe a short story. I would entreat my readers to send in articles and stories too, because I wasn't that prolific, and I felt like I would run out after a while, if not of time and opportunity, then of my materials. So a few girls sent in some poems and some little items of this and that, but they didn't really get into it, and I wish they had. It was a very slim magazine, maybe about 9 pages in one, 16 in the next, but the reason it was so slim was that it was so very hard to turn it out. And then if anybody came around, I had to zip it into my briefcase quick or my desk drawer. But I had a lot of fun doing it, and I would give it away to my friends. There was one stipulation. I didn't want to make money off it, I just wanted to give it away. I had no idea how daring or dangerous this was. I used to mail them blithely out from the place where I worked until somebody said, don't you know you could get in trouble for mailing this? I didn't know why. There were no four-letter words or pictures in it, nothing that could be misconstrued as something sexual. I didn't name the names of places where people congregated. But they said, we're telling you for your own good, you better not do that anymore. So I took their advice and distributed them personally, and I'd say, when you're through with it, pass it on, because there aren't that many of them, and I'd like to get them to as many people as I can. Some of the readers thought, gee, you're just too much, or I think you're a little silly. Some people asked me why I did it in the first place, and I said, because we don't have any gay magazines, and I think we should. It would be lovely even if someone started up one in addition to mine. But they still thought I was a little off-center for doing it. Others would say, yeah, I think it's a keen idea. I'll send you some material sometime, which was never. One time, I took the magazine down with me to the IF Club, and some of my friends were horrified, and they said, don't you know if there's a raid here and they confiscated that, they could throw you in prison? And I said, what for? My name isn't in there. Nobody's name is in there. I purposely left all names out of there. So that was the story about my gay magazine, Vice Versa. And it went on for 9 months. Unlike the Myrtle Beach Bitch, copies of Vice Versa still survive. And I have a Xerox copy of one of them here if you want to look at it later. The first issue, which Lisa Ben typed up for distribution in June of 1947, began with this explanation. Have you ever stopped to enumerate the many different publications to be found on the average newsstand? Yet there is one kind of publication which has never appeared on the stands. Newsstands carrying the crudest kind of magazines appealing to the vulgar would find themselves severely censured were they to display this other type of publication. Why? Because society decrees it thus. Hence the appearance of Vice Versa, a magazine dedicated, in all seriousness, to those of us who will never quite be able to adapt ourselves to the iron-bound rules of convention. Vice Versa, because of limited circulation and crude reproduction methods, is at present published irregularly whenever there is enough material gathered together for another edition, and it is offered free of charge. However, just because the magazine is gratis does not indicate that work and effort have not been expended in publishing it. So if Vice Versa does not appeal to you, either refuse it or pass it along to somebody else. But please, let's keep it just between us girls. That's how she spelled police. A few issues later, in response to a reader's letter praising the magazine, Lisa Ben wrote, your letter is very flattering. I have never considered Vice Versa as a courageous venture. I believe that there is a definite need for such a magazine among the gay folk. Vice Versa was long a fond dream of mine ere it came into reality in June 1947. It is my personal contribution to others of my ilk, meant to provide an outlet for the creative self-expression so often of necessity pent up within us. In another issue, a reader wrote, our thanks to you for sending us the copies of your magazine. We have enjoyed reading them, and I personally felt that sought-after feeling of actually belonging to a group somewhere in society while reading your magazine. Lisa Ben responded, I wonder if you realize just how greatly pleased I was by your remark that reading Vice Versa made you feel as if you were part of a group? This is precisely the feeling that I would like to impart through our publication. that even though readers may never actually become acquainted with one another, they will find a sort of spiritual communion through this little magazine, which is written by and for those of our inclinations. As long as I know that my friends enjoy reading Vice Versa, I shall try to keep on publishing it for as long as circumstances permit. And finally, in an article entitled Here to Stay, Lisa Ben reveals her dream for the future. Whether the unsympathetic majority approves or not, it looks as though the third sex is here to stay. Nightclubs featuring male and female impersonators are becoming increasingly prevalent. Even cafes and drive-ins intended for the average customer, when repeatedly patronized by inverts, tend to reflect a gay atmosphere. Books such as Diana and The Well of Loneliness are now available in inexpensive editions at bookmarts and even drugstores. With such knowledge being disseminated through fact and fiction to the public, homosexuality is becoming less and less a taboo subject, and although still considered by the public as contemptible, I venture to predict that there will be a time in the future when gay folk will be accepted as part of regular society. Perhaps even Vice Versa might be the forerunner of better magazines dedicated to the third sex, which in some future time might take their rightful place on the newsstands beside other publications to be available openly and without restriction to those who wish to read them. The eighth and last issue of Vice Versa appeared in January 1948. In January of 1953, One Incorporated, an early homophile organization in LA, printed 1,000 copies of One magazine. You can look at this later if you're very careful. Copy of the first issue of One magazine. And this magazine became the first explicitly gay magazine to appear on U.S. newsstands. One magazine was followed by the Mattachine Review, published by the Mattachine Society. You can read more about these publications in a new book that just came out this week by John D'Amelio called Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities, The Making of a Homosexual Minority in the United States, 1940 to 1970. These little magazines represented the beginnings of an organized gay press in America. But still, no lesbian newsletter or magazines had come out since Vice Versa's last issue in 48. In the mid-1950s, however, a second attempt was made to start a lesbian newsletter, this time here in San Francisco. In early 1955, a woman named Jackie, and her lover, two WACs who were stationed at the Presidio, they were interrogated during a nightmare anti-lesbian witch hunt here and thrown out of the army with dishonorable discharges. The two women began renting an apartment together here in the city. With bad discharge papers from the army, they had trouble finding work, but finally Jackie got a job in a paper bag factory and her lover got a job as a key punch operator. The anger and the scars of the army witch hunt, however, continued to haunt them, so they limited their social life to quiet visits in the homes of women they'd met in the service and stayed out of the bars. One night, Jackie recalls, while visiting at the home of two friends, we met some other women who were gay and who were also angry. All of us had read all this crap about how sick we were, and we didn't feel sick. We were very young then, so we decided we were going to do something about it. We were going to form an organization, and we were going to fight the world and let them know that we weren't sick. We'd gotten hold of a magazine called One. It wasn't even safe to buy a copy of that magazine in those days. I bought a copy once. The man who owned the bookstore, after I'd gotten outside, he came out and he called me a dirty lezzy, and that he should call the cops on me, and that I should be burned at the stake, and he kept yelling at me all the way down the street. And this was one of the things that made me angry. So we decided that we were going to do something. We were going to form an organization and liberate the world. When I look back on it now, it seems funny, but it wasn't funny then. There were five of us, my lover and myself, another couple, and one other woman. We decided we were going to put out a paper called Eclipse. The reason we chose the name Eclipse was that we felt like there was a shadow over the earth, and we were living under the shadow, but because it was only an eclipse, the sun was going to move out and shine on us, and eventually we were going to stop living in the shadows. Well, we would all get together and sort of brainstorm about what we wanted to write about. We felt that we had a message to get out to gay women, and we had a message to get out to the world, saying to the world, take another look. We're not what you're saying we are. We are not sick, and we want you to know this. And this is why we don't think we're sick, because we go to work every day like everybody else, and we pay taxes, and we're like anyone else. We didn't know much how to say that, and I mean, that's almost the exact words we were using. The equipment we had was, well, one of the women had an old broken-down typewriter, and our printing press was this child's thing. You made little mimeographed drawings and stuff on it. It had a sponge rubber base, and you printed with that. You put this ink on it, and then lay a paper on it, and rubbed a cloth over it, and, well, it was only a toy. Each eclipse was only one page, so we didn't have much room either. One of the things that was in all of them was an appeal for people, women. I don't believe we were thinking very much about men at the time, of other women to come and join us. We didn't have a means to do this with. Like, join us, but where? Because we thought we had to keep things secret. There was a great deal of fear about revealing anyone's name or phone number or address. What we used to do if we met someone, especially if we got their phone number, we would either commit it to memory or we would write it on a piece of Kleenex or toilet paper and carry that in a very handy pocket. And if we were approached by the police, well, it's very easy to eat that kind of paper. So we wanted to use the eclipse to tell other gay women that we did exist and we wanted them to join us. And we did have a cafe picked out on the corner of 7th and Market Street, near where we lived. So we said in the newsletter, if you read this, be at this cafe at a certain time, and you will see us there. We mimeographed these things off, and we didn't have any idea how or to whom we were going to distribute them. And so we would leave them around at bus stops and in women's restrooms. That's very ingenious. We tried the Greyhound bus depot, and someone picked one up and read it, and they called the police. We would put these papers down. In the morning, we put down a little bundle of papers. We'd leave 5 or 10 in one locality. People would pick them up and see what it was about, and, well, they'd just cuss us out and harass us. And so far as I know, no one ever came to the cafe. One of us would go there at the given time, and we'd look around, and to the best of our knowledge, nobody ever came. I think we printed Eclipse 3 times and decided it was more or less hopeless and that we were running some risks. We had heard from no one. We didn't know if anybody read them with anything but laughter. And we realized that we were actually giving ourselves a bad image rather than a good image because we knew we were frowned on for even mentioning it and for leaving that sort of material around in public. Then one of the women found out that leaving it in the bus depot was illegal and that we could all be arrested. Like I say, when we first started out, we knew we were going to change the world. I think that was one of our downfalls. We got this first issue out in only a few months, so we were very excited about it, but when nothing happened, we got very discouraged. And we had no resources and no support to continue it, and we were afraid of repercussions. So our little group more or less disbanded. So by the early 1960s, the idea of a gay publication wasn't funny anymore. Lisa Ben's dream of seeing gay magazines for sale on public newsstands had finally become a reality. It's remarkable that we can meet here today as a gay press association, while only 30 or 40 years ago, people like Lisa Ben, Jackie, and the GIs at Myrtle Beach were considered foolhardy for trying to start what we now take for granted. The gay and lesbian press has already come so far that these early newsletters seem quaint and homemade to us today. Who knows, maybe 30 years from now, in the year 2013, our publications, our TV and radio shows, the GPA computer network wire service, even this conference, may all seem just as homegrown and quaint as these early newsletters seem to us today. Be that as it may, we're here in this room today because the lesbian and gay press has grown up. This year, in fact, marks the 30th anniversary of the beginning of a continuous gay press in the United States. The purpose of this conference is to take concrete steps toward even more growth in the next decades by improving the caliber of professionalism in the gay and lesbian media. We deserve and need to teach each other more about fundraising and advertising, to continue creating our own code of ethics, to gain more access to computer technology, to develop more efficient information exchange networks, to expand our readership and distribution, to improve the quality of our writing and graphics and production work, to find ways to pay our writers, and to support and strengthen organizations like the Gay Press Association. But as we continue to mature and become more professional, we have to be careful not to lose sight of the original impulse behind our efforts. 40 years ago, that impulse appeared raw and naked in the pages of these homemade newsletters as a gut-level hunger for gay community. It's what drove these daring and campy pioneers to risk arrest and prison sentences, to ignore the fearful warnings of their friends, to scrounge together ridiculously primitive printing tools, even to steal government supplies and illegally use the mails. Because deep in their guts, these women and men felt a special kind of hunger that only a gay press could satisfy, a need to create a gay community where none existed before, and to make that community real by seeing our own newsletter, our own little magazine, our own newspaper in each other's hands. It is this impulse, this hunger, that keeps our press alive today. I hope that by remembering the stories of the Myrtle Beach Bitch, Vice Versa, and The Eclipse, you'll stay in touch with that original impulse, that hunger for community, and use it as a touchstone as we help each other create a stronger and even more professional lesbian and gay press. Thank you.